Canada has the world's longest ocean coastline. Under the sea, Canada has also presided over the mass death of fish and mammal species, the largest loss of invertebrates in the country's history. In this Canada Oceans Lecture 2008, Professor Jeff Hutchings delivers a stinging lament for a nation's oceans. It was recorded at the Wask Center in downtown Vancouver, October 22, 2008. This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. We'll spend this hour exploring ocean exploitation and the unreported story of death down under. Professor Jeff Hutchings is a professor of biology and the Canada Research Chair in Marine Conservation and Biodiversity at Dalhousie University. He is also the chair of the Committee on the Status of Endangered Wildlife in Canada, COSWIC, the national science advisory body responsible for advising the Federal Minister of the Environment on the status of species at risk in Canada. The circular WASC Center was filled with eminent oceans experts, government representatives, environmentalists, and concerned citizens, some of whom had to be turned away at the door. Professor Hutchings uses some of the restrained language of a top advisor, but he breaks through to warn us that government is failing to save what is left of our maritime natural resources.
Well, thank you very much. Lament for nations' oceans. What I want to do this evening is break the talk up into basically three parts. The initial part will have some very general things to say about oceans, but then focus in particular on two of the primary human-induced stressors that are currently affecting the state of our ocean's health. I then want to turn to consider some management and legislative tools that have been used, notably by other countries, for addressing overfishing and for rebuilding depleted stocks of fishes. And lastly, end on a note, hopefully, of optimism to acknowledge that perhaps there is reason to think that things can improve, but that it might not be easy and that some of the potential solutions might not be palatable to everyone, but I hope that they serve as a point of departure for discussion. Lament for a Nation's Oceans. I clearly didn't come up with this title in entirety on my own. There's a certain amount of plagiarism involved, and I'll happily acknowledge that plagiarism in part to George Grant, the Dalhousie University professor of philosophy, who wrote Lament for a Nation in 1965, bemoaning what he viewed to be the loss of Canadian nationalism because of the Pearson government's decision to put the American Bismarck missiles on our soil. But the title also comes from a book penned by Michael Harris in 1998, Lament for an Ocean, in which he described the bureaucratic, managerial, and scientific machinations that conspired to result in the collapse of the cod off Canada's east coast. Now, it should be of no surprise to people in this room that Canada's coastline is the largest in the world. Indeed, depending on which estimates you look at, Canada's coastline comprises somewhere between 16 and 20% of the world's coastlines. Thus, Canada certainly has the geological or geographical imperative, if not the moral and ethical imperative, to take leadership on ocean matters. The degree to which we have is a point of discussion. There is clearly a myriad of ways in which the oceans are of benefit to the biota of the globe, and much as I dislike the term ecosystem services, it is something that is used by many as probably an appropriate communications tool when dealing with decision makers, when dealing with a variety of different individuals, to make the point that the oceans are actually more than simply a repository of water on this planet. They provide, amongst other things, a primary source of protein and food for the world. Cultural and spiritual values that cannot be easily quantified. Its nutrient cycling responsibilities are clearly very important, as are its role in the moderation of our climate. And when we have issues related to climate change, we have to be cognizant of how the effects of climate change on our oceans can affect us meteorologically. And of course, there's a sense of wonder and aesthetic beauty to the oceans that's not easily quantified either, but means something to us all. Of the two human stressors that I mentioned earlier, one is clearly related to climate change as a consequence of increased greenhouse gas emissions. And if you haven't seen this slide, you're certainly almost certainly aware of what its message is. And it shows over the last 2,000 years changes in the abundance of three key greenhouse gases, carbon dioxide, methane, and nitrous oxide. And you'll note in particular the massive rise in these gases after 1750, the late 18th century initiation of the Industrial Revolution. And it's certainly the opinion of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change that this rise in greenhouse gas emissions is human-induced, which begs the question of what influence this might have to oceanic climate change. There's almost certainly a variety of ways in which greenhouse gas emissions are affecting the oceans. Over the last 50 years, the ocean's net heat uptake has been considerably greater than that absorbed by the atmosphere. And indeed, here are the data that will back that up from the IPCC's study. Basically, what you see here for different entities, including the oceans at the top, the atmosphere towards the bottom, and ice sheets in the middle, for two different periods of time, you see the heat uptake that's taken place over those two periods of time. And you'll note in particular that for the oceans, since 1961, 90% of the global heat uptake has been borne by the oceans, not by the atmosphere. And this will have clear, if unpredictable, consequences for things that live in the ocean, for us as well, because oceanic transport of heat affects weather patterns in a variety of different ways. Other ways in which climate change has affected the ocean to greater or lesser degrees: the ocean is made up of a number of water masses. These are changing in size, they're changing in temperature and salinity, and to a greater or lesser degree, there are changes in circulation patterns as well. There's concerns that the biogeochemistry of the ocean is changing, with increased absorption of inorganic carbon is leading to increased acidity in parts of the oceans. And sea levels are rising, albeit what might be considered to be slowly, but importantly, there's increased variance in sea levels. And one manifestation of this has to do with a variety of plants that exist on Canada's coast. Indeed, there are some plants that are at risk in Canada because of the increased frequency of winter storms at sea brought about by climate change. So that's one of the biological consequences of oceanic climate change. What are some other potential consequences? Well, there are almost certainly, to greater or lesser degrees, at large or small spatial scales, be changes in ocean productivity. There will almost certainly be shifts in the distributions of various species. A number of marine species determine their spatial distributions on the basis of temperature, and there's good evidence to suggest that certain groups of marine organisms have already experienced significant spatial shifts in their distributions. And these distributional shifts by individual species will almost certainly have consequences for marine food webs, where we have changes in the relative abundance of various competitors, species competing for the same resource, or we have changes in the relative abundance of predators and their prey. And the consequences to marine food webs will almost certainly be considerable in some cases, but again, not entirely predictable. And there will be an alteration or a deterioration or a loss of habitat wrought by oceanic climate change. And the best example of this is probably that of changes in seasonal or summer sea ice availability. What you see in this figure is the extent of sea ice in the month of September in the Arctic from 1900 carried through to projections through the 21st century. There's a lot of different lines on there. They each represent the predicted changes from 13 different climate change models, with the ensemble mean of all of those models shown as the predicted line in black. The observed changes, the observed reductions in September sea ice, are shown in red. And as, again, many of you are probably aware, the observed changes, the observed reductions in sea ice availability have been more extensive than those predicted. And seasonal summer sea ice, or seasonal sea ice, is a critical part of the habitat required by polar bears. This was something that was acknowledged by Kosiwik, which assessed the polar bear earlier this year. And as John indicated earlier, Kosiwik is Canada's national science advisory body on species at risk. It advises the Federal Minister of the Environment as to which species to potentially include or to include on Canada's legal list of species at risk. It's a body that was formed in 1977, conducted its first assessments in 1978, and its functions are recognized by legislation under the Species at Risk Act in 2003. So I now would like to turn to a consideration of each of our three coastlines and some of the biodiversity consequences that these two, or I should say two human stressors, one being climate change and one being overexploitation, have brought. The Arctic coastline comprises about three quarters of Canada's coastline. And for those of you who haven't been there, there's some pack ice in the northern Beaufort Sea. This is a photograph I took while flying up the west side of Ellesmere Island in 2005. And here's a Coast Guard vessel off Devon Island. And from a species at risk perspective, I'd like to focus on three: the polar bear, the beluga whale, and the peary caribou. The polar bear was assessed by CSIWC as a species of special concern in April of this year. And for management purposes, polar bears are identified as 13 different subpopulations, which are indicated in this map. And with respect to all of these subpopulations, two between Canada and Greenland are deemed to be declining or predicted to decline over the next 30 to 40 years, in this case primarily because of overharvesting. In southern Beaufort Sea and the western Hudson Bay, polar bear populations are predicted to decline because of loss of summer sea ice. In other parts of the range, there's stability that has been observed and predicted. In three subpopulations, the polar bear is increasing in abundance after having been driven to extremely low levels by overharvesting, and it's not entirely clear what's happening with the populations in Fox Basin or Davis Strait. And the threats identified by CSIWC to the polar bear were climate change, notably in the south, overharvesting in particular areas, and oil and gas development in the Beaufort Sea. And the question of whether to include the polar bear on the SARA species at risk list is currently with the federal minister. The beluga whale is another biologically and culturally integral species to the Inuit, and it exists throughout the Arctic as far south as the St. Lawrence River off Saguenay and Quebec City, where it's considered to be threatened, and the six other units of beluga whale range in status from endangered to not at risk in the Beaufort Sea, and the primary threat to the beluga is unsustainable levels of harvesting. But for those of you who are interested in the ways that climate change can affect biodiversity and species at risk, the polar bear may be of interest, but it's the peary caribou to which your attention should be primarily drawn. The peary caribou exists throughout the high Arctic, and it was assessed as endangered by CSIWC in 2004 because of massive reductions in abundance, as you can see from these numbers. Indeed, since 1961, peary caribou have declined 83%. Now, one often hears when dealing with climate change, and if you were to look at some of the measurable levels in terms of temperature change and sea level change, you might say, in an absolute sense, that doesn't seem like very much. It's rather difficult to imagine that such small absolute changes are likely to affect species very much. But in this case, they can considerably, just a degree or two change, significantly affects the peary caribou because climate warming has resulted in increased precipitation. More snow, more freezing rain, which reduces access of peary caribou to its food source. And the end result has been many episodes of mass starvation. It's probably the best example in Canada of a link between climate change and the reduction of a species. On the west coast, the Pacific coastline takes up or comprises about 10% of Canada's entire coastline. This is off Haida Gwaii, Orcas off in the Strait of Georgia, and Johnson Strait. And from a species at risk perspective, I'd like to touch upon the killer whale, the basking shark, rockfish, and sockeye salmon. The killer whale was assessed by CSIWC in 2001 as four different units, and you can see them there. Some are designated as resident units, others are transient, and these units of killer whales differ in a variety of different characteristics. The transients, for example, tend to feed on other marine mammals. The residents tend to feed on fish. These resident populations in the Northeast Pacific transient population have been exceedingly well studied. They're known to the individual animal. There's fewer than 100 of the southern residents, and there's about 200 of the northern residents. And you can see the various levels of status that CSIWC has given to the killer whale. And the federal government has, in fact, accepted CSIWC's advice in this regard. And indeed, we're going to be reassessing the killer whale next month. The basking shark was assessed as endangered by CSIWC in 2007. This is Canada's largest fish. It attains sizes of about 12 meters, as big as a school bus. It's not a carnivorous shark. It feeds on small plankton and small food particles in the ocean, but it has declined dramatically. Around Vancouver Island in the 30s and the 40s, there were reports of tens, if not hundreds, of basking sharks seen in very small spatial areas. Since 1996, there have been six observed off British Columbia's coast. They've declined by an estimated 90%, if not more, for two reasons. One was a fishery for its liver in the 1940s, and the second was a government-sponsored eradication program that extended from 1954 to 1970. Now, the problem was that basking sharks were deemed to be a pest because they like to bask. They hang about near the surface of the ocean and, as a consequence, become entangled in gill nets and, indeed, some of the troll fisheries for salmon. So to deal with these pests, it was deemed that what one should do is to try to eradicate the pest in some manner. And this is nicely described in a book by Scott Wallace and Brian Gisborne, published a couple of years ago. And basically what was fashioned was a large blade that was put on the bow of the fisheries patrol vessel, the Comox Post. And when a whale was seen, the vessel drove into the whale and struck it and killed it. And if you want to see that blade, apparently it's on display at the Port Alberni Museum. But that was a prime reason for the reduction in the basking shark. And that decision whether to include the basking shark on Canada's legal list is before the minister. The rockfishes off BC, to my mind, are one of the great gems of this part of the world. They're the coral reef analogs of the North Pacific. They have wonderful life histories. They're extraordinary longevity. But unfortunately, as with many coral reef fishes, a number of them are in trouble. Including the canary rockfish and the boccaccio, which are estimated to have declined by more than 80% for each. The long-spined thornyhead experienced a 50% decline over an eight-year period because of a directed fishery. And the rough-eye rockfish has also been assessed as a species of special concern. So these rockfishes have been identified as species at risk in Canada, and all of these fishes are before the minister for consideration for listing.
You're listening to Professor Jeff Hutchings with his Lament for a Nation's Oceans on Radio EcoShock.
From a salmon perspective, Cosiwik has assessed the status of four groups of salmon, two sockeye salmon populations, one Chinook and one coho group, and we will be assessing them to a much greater degree within a 2 to 4 year period. But the IUCN, as you might be aware, over the last couple of weeks or so, released a report of their assessment of the global status of sockeye salmon throughout the North Pacific. And among the 27 subpopulations, there's 80 in total, of the 27 in British Columbia for which there's sufficient data to make an assessment, almost half were deemed by the IUCN to be at some level of risk. That is, they were critically endangered, indicated in red, endangered, that's the area in orange, or vulnerable, which is equivalent to a threatened status in Canada, in yellow. And again, habitat destruction and overexploitation were identified as the primary threats. And on the Atlantic coast comprises the remainder of the coastline. Roughly 20% of Canada's coastline is on the Atlantic. This is Cape Race and the southeastern tip of Newfoundland, where I've done a fair bit of research. Battle Harbour in Labrador, which was a site of basically an industrial site for the fishery in the beginning in the 19th century. And this is what it's like at times on the Grand Bank. And from a species at risk perspective, I'd like to focus on three: the winter skate, the poor beagle, which is a shark, and the Atlantic cod. This is the winter skate. The winter skate exists from Newfoundland south to and including George's Bank, which is shared between Canada and the United States. Of the four units identified by Cosiwik, one is in the southern Gulf of St. Lawrence and estimated to have declined, based on fisheries and oceans data, by 98% as a consequence of exploitation. The decision whether to include this species in the legal list is currently with the minister. The poor beagle is the only shark in Canadian waters for which there is a directed harvest quota. Based on a decline of roughly 90% over a 40-year period, it was assessed as endangered by Cosiwik in 2004, but the minister rejected Cosiwik's advice and decided not to include the poor beagle on the legal list. Why not? Well, it would result in a loss of an important source of income for two fishermen. There are eight license holders, and it might have resulted in a 2% economic loss to a single community. It might have resulted in a loss of $1 to $2 million over a 20-year period. And it might have cost $50,000 a year to replace the fishery, if you will, and the information that can be obtained from the fishery by a directed survey. So these were the stated reasons for not including the poor beagle on the legal list of species at risk in Canada. And basically, this decision communicated to many observers an unwritten and unspoken policy, perhaps by the Department of Fisheries and Oceans, not to include any marine fishes on the SARA legal list, no matter what the perceived socioeconomic costs of doing so. The Atlantic cod was assessed by Kosiwik in 2003 as four separate units, and based on a perceived change in the status of the population of cod, which I'll talk about towards the end of the talk, Kosiwik will be reassessing cod next year. The four units identified by cod ranged in assessment or status from special concern to endangered. The special concern cod, at least the northernmost ones, are found in Baffin Island. Now, these are particularly interesting groups of cod, notably from a biodiversity perspective, but also from a genetic and life history perspective. These are cod that are unfished. They are found in coastal lakes, only three on Baffin Island, and one of the lakes is seen in this figure here. This is Frobisher Bay in the foreground. This is a site where a student of mine, David Hardy, and I have done some work. And in essence, the massive tides in this part of the world, which exceed 11.5 meters, the highest tides of each month, there's a massive influx of nutrients and salt water into the lakes, which provides habitat and sustenance for the cod that live there. The cod are quite large because they are unexploited. There are three populations, as I've said. We're still awaiting a decision from the federal government as to whether they're going to include them on the legal list as special concern. But nonetheless, they're the northernmost ones on Baffin. Moving farther south, we have the northern cod. And the northern cod were part of a unit assessed by Kosiwik as endangered. Why? Because of a 99% decline in abundance from 1962 to 1992. Now, this is a fishery that's not a new fishery. This is a fishery that's been exploited for over 500 years. And indeed, the means of catching cod up until the last 20 or 30 years of the fishery, for the most part, were not that different from what it was 300 or 400 years ago. In fact, the means of drying the fish before selling the fish, which is what you see here, really hasn't changed. What you see in these figures are flakes, and all the white spots are cod that have been salted, and they're left on the flakes to dry in the sun and the wind before sale or before being consumed. And you can see the flakes there in the 16th century are really not that much different from those in the 20th century. This is an estimate of the catches of northern cod over the last 500 years that Ransom Myers and I undertook in the mid-1990s. And notably, in the 1800s, from 1850 to 1950, it appears as though catches were sustainable at an extremely large level, between 200,000 and 300,000 metric tons. Now, sometimes it's difficult to sort of wrap your head around what some of these numbers mean. So for comparative purposes with the salmon catches here in British Columbia, you can see here are some averages of British Columbian catches of the five species of Pacific salmon from 1925 to 2003. And the catches of cod were, as you can see, rather large, even with respect to those of sockeye. Well, what does this mean numerically? It actually represents this 99% reduction in abundance is not something that many people think about. NGOs, those concerned with conservation from a variety of perspectives, tend not to focus on marine fish. They tend to focus on other species for a variety of different reasons. But the reduction in cod was really an extraordinary one. Here are some other species that one may or may not think about from a conservation perspective and some of their abundance estimates prior to the settlement of the Europeans. A peregrine falcon, probably numbered about 5,000. The spotted owl, the poor spotted owl, for which there's about 10 breeding pairs remaining and will probably be extirpated within the decade, has a pre-European settlement abundance estimate of 1,000. Bison throughout North America were thought to number 30 million, not just in Canada, but throughout North America. And the beaver, although it's not a species at risk, it is something that we exploited considerably as a result of the fur trade, and its abundance estimate was 6 million prior to the settlement of the Europeans. For cod, over the space of 30 years, a single human generation, the loss has been more than 2 billion. More than 2 billion breeding individuals. Numerically, the decline of cod must be considered to be the greatest numerical loss of a vertebrate in Canadian history. We tend not to view it as such, but I think it's a difficult argument, a difficult premise to argue against. Now, in terms of weight, how else might one communicate this loss? Well, let's transform that weight into polar bears. It would be roughly 6 million polar bears. How many are in Canada? About 15,000 polar bears. Certainly not 6 million. What would it mean in terms of the total weight of humans? About 27 million. Not much less than the size of Canada. And 27 million is far in excess of the numbers of Canadians in reproductive condition, if I can use it that way. So the point simply being that the loss of cod numerically and from a biomass perspective is an extraordinary one. Why? Because we overfished it. On the y-axis, you can see measures of what's called fishing mortality. On the x-axis, year. For those of you unfamiliar with what F represents, you can see the percentages on that y-axis, and they represent the percentage of the cod population that was extracted by fishing in any given year. The black line shows you the actual exploitation levels, or the actual levels of fishing from 1962 to 1992. The red shows you the intended or the target levels of fishing. And the blue shows you the hypothesized sustainable levels of exploitation for northern cod. It's quite clear that we never, not only did we not achieve the intended management targets for fishing mortality, but even those were in excess of what we deemed to be, at the most optimistic level, a sustainable level of exploitation. So on the basis, then, of these declines that have taken place, it begs the question of what indeed happened on the management side, what happened on the scientific side. Well, I'm not going to go into that because that's a topic for another time. But we can ask the question, what have been the responses to such extraordinary declines and such extraordinary levels of over-exploitation? In considering some of the management and legislative tools that are and have been available for a while, let's consider a couple of premises. The first is that Canada's fisheries are a common property resource. They belong to all of us. They belong to all of the people of Canada. Second premise is that it is the Minister of Fisheries and Oceans' duty to manage, conserve, and develop the fisheries on behalf of Canadians in the public interest. And if you don't accept those assertions or assumptions or premises of mine, they don't actually originate with me. They originate with the Supreme Court of Canada in a decision that they made, rendered in 1997. So what are some of the tools that are available? Well, Canada is a signatory to a variety of international agreements, one of which is the UN Fish Stocks Agreement in 1995. Now, under that agreement, it is specified that signatories will apply or shall apply the precautionary approach. Canada agreed. When the Oceans Act came into force in 1996, the preamble states that Canada promotes the wide application of the precautionary approach to the conservation, management, and exploitation of marine resources. What is the precautionary approach? Well, the Privy Council Office also agreed that this was an important consideration in a document that they published in 2003. Precautionary approach essentially recognizes that the absence of full scientific certainty shall not be used as a reason for postponing decisions where there is a risk of serious or irreversible harm. So how might that translate into a fisheries management scenario? If a stock were to fall below a specified level, a target, such that it might be at risk of serious or irreversible harm, in other words, it might not recover, then the lack of full scientific certainty should not be used as a reason for not taking very strong action to cease over-exploitation and to rebuild the fishery.
You are listening to the Canadian Oceans Lecture for 2008, delivered by Professor Jeff Hutchings of Dalhousie University. He's also the top scientific advisor to the Canadian government on endangered species. We'll continue in just 30 seconds. If you were just tuning in, this is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith. We return to a speech by Professor Jeff Hutchings as he laments the mismanagement that is killing off fish and mammals in Canadian waters along the world's longest coastline. It's a breakthrough speech by a scientist frustrated by industry and government inaction and mismanagement of precious ocean resources. He calls it a lament for a nation's oceans.
The UN Fish Stocks Agreement says further that in implementing the precautionary approach, states shall determine stock-specific reference points and the action to be taken if the reference points are exceeded. In other words, the argument here is that there should be a plan. There should be targets. There should be measurable objectives against which management plans can be defensibly constructed and against which they can be judged by society, by industry, by all who are affected. And the FAO went on, the Food and Agricultural Organization part of the UN, to develop guidelines to implement the precautionary approach. It is recommended that reference points for two things, fishing mortality and stock size or biomass, be agreed upon to identify overexploitation, to determine when it's happening, to guide rebuilding plans, and to develop rules for how to control fishing mortality, depending on how far away you are from your targets. So it was very clear in the mid-90s as to what the expectations were of the signatories to this international agreement. So what are reference points? Very simply, in a graphical sense, because it's kind of an important point, if you'll bear with me for a couple of minutes, here are essentially what reference points are. And there's two types. There are target reference points and limit reference points. And basically, what we have here is a target for biomass, a target for stock size, and here's another target for fishing mortality. And what these target reference points do is they define an area where you want to be. They define the area, the stock size, that you want it to be at. In other words, in that green area, if you follow along the x-axis or the horizontal axis, we are above the biomass target. We've got more fish than we wanted in our target. And we're below, on the vertical axis, our target level of fishing mortality. So we're not fishing as hard as, or we're under our target. That's where we want to be. Targets identify where we want to be. Limit reference points for fishing mortality and stock size tell us where we don't want to be. So in this blue area, it implies we've got a low stock size. Our biomass is low relative to what we want it to be. It's below our limit biomass, our limit reference point for stock size. This defines an area of serious harm vis-a-vis the precautionary approach. And I've shaded this in color. It's darker towards the top because as we go up in this rectangle, we are fishing at a harder and harder rate, making it more and more imperative that action be taken to rebuild the stock. And similarly, the red zone identifies areas where we are fishing above our limit reference point for fishing. We are seriously overfishing the stock. Again, the limit reference points identify an area of serious harm where we don't want to be according to the precautionary approach. And the black identifies an area where we are seriously, we're below our limit reference point for stock size, we're above our fishing level, and we are overfishing a seriously depleted stock. Well, in the mid-1990s, the Auditor General of Canada examined Canada's fishery management plans and criticized them for a couple of reasons, or for several reasons, but two of which are indicated here. It made the point that objectives are often not stipulated, they're not measurable, they're unclear, and this is not helpful. And they said that the precautionary approach has not been implemented, and it ought to be. Well, that was the mid-90s. Perhaps things have changed. This is a paper that just came out in the most recent issue of the Canadian Journal of Fisheries and Aquatic Sciences, and it's penned by two fisheries and ocean scientists, one in Newfoundland and one in British Columbia. And their conclusion is that although much good policy on sustainable fisheries management exists, implementation on marine capture fisheries off the coasts of Canada has occurred slowly, if at all. So who's using reference points? Precautionary approach, UN fish stocks agreement stipulated that we ought to be. who has been, Europe has been, through what's called ICES, the International Council for the Exploration of the Sea, there are reference points specified for all harvested stocks. New Zealand has them. The United States is using them. We're not. And I want to consider the US legislation because, although 10 or 15 years ago I don't think I would have thought this, today I think I do. I think maybe this is something worth considering. And the end point here is an argument for proscriptive legislation as opposed to discretionary legislation. The U.S. has something called the Magnuson-Stevens Fishery Conservation and Management Act, and amendments in 1996 stipulated very clearly that any management plan prepared by the Secretary of Commerce, which is analogous to the Minister of Fisheries and Oceans, not may, but shall, contain measures necessary to prevent or end overfishing and rebuild overfished stocks. It's made very, very plain in the Act, sections 303 and 304. It says that a management plan shall specify objective and measurable criteria, reference points, just what I've been talking about, for determining when a fishery has been overfished. And within 2 years of receiving advice that a fishery has been overfished, the Secretary must establish a plan of rebuilding the overfished stocks such that rebuilding takes place over a 10-year period. Now, that's clearly not always going to be possible, but the key element here is that a rebuilding plan is in place. It's required by legislation, and there are reference points and targets that are all also made very, very clear. Does it work? I mean, it's fine to have a legislative tool, but if the implementation of that tool is ineffective, then it's not necessarily a road that one wants to go down. What you see on the y-axis is the spawning stock biomass of three different types of ground fish on the East Coast, on the Georges Bank portion, on the U.S. portion of Georges Bank. Cod are in the dark blue, haddock in the dotted lines, and yellowtail, which is a flounder, a flatfish, on the open squares. So this is just prior to the amendments of the Act in the mid-90s. And this prompted a variety of management plan initiatives, such as capping participation in the fishery, reducing effort. There were vessel buyout plans. There were further reductions in 1996 in catch and effort. Then in 1999, there were targets for rebuilding and harvest control rules put in place. And that's where things were in 2001. So if one asks the question, can recovery and can rebuilding take place or be in association with or be a consequence of prescriptive legislation in this regard, the answer is it can. I would argue there's cause and effect. Others might simply say it's an associative relationship, but I think the cause and effect argument is a reasonable one. And this is the sort of thing that one sees in the annual report that is provided to Congress on the state of U.S. fisheries for a variety of different fish stocks. You see graphs like this, which have year along the horizontal axis and two lines. The pink line and the blue line are both telling you something about the level of fishing mortality and the stock size relative to limit and target reference points. And in this case, for the bluefish, the pink line is going down. That's the fishing mortality on bluefish relative to its target fishing mortality. Fishing's going down, and the bluefish are responding positively by increasing in abundance. Here's an example of a species that is international. In international waters, it's highly migratory, for which what do we see? We see just the opposite. Fishing mortality continues to increase. 2002, 2003, the observed fishing mortality level is almost double the target. The consequence to bluefin tuna is a reduction in biomass. What's Canada's experience been in this regard? Well, we made very initial and very tentative forays into this in the early 2000s at the time that the Species at Risk Act was going to be passed, because it was felt that there was going to be a need for such reference points if things were going to be listed on the Species at Risk Act. Southern Gulf Cod, you can see its location there. The biomass limit reference point that was established by DFO scientists was 80,000 metric tons. So just as a reminder, that limit reference point is identifying a stock size below which serious or irreversible harm might be experienced by the stock in question. The current spawner biomass level is well below the limit reference point. Was there a fishery this year? Yes. And what's the prognosis for biomass in the future? Further decline. Let's look at Northern Gulf cod. The biomass limit reference point that was established by scientists was between 85,000 and 110,000 metric tons. Where are we at present? We're at 37,000 metric tons in the area of serious harm. Was there a fishery this year? Yes, 7,000-ton fishery. Biomass prognosis, further decline in stock size. And the third cod stock for which a limit reference point was identified was for northern cod. The biomass limit reference point is rather difficult to pin down, and you can see there's a huge range, but the low range is pretty high, 150,000 metric tons. Where are we today? It's difficult to estimate, but we're almost certainly below 50,000 metric tons. Is there a fishery this year? Yes. And the prognosis for future trends in biomass is not a positive one. So I've said something about the fact that there are perhaps at least two different types of legislative tools. Prescriptive tools, which prohibit ministers or secretaries from doing certain things, which prescribe certain types of action and things that one must do if certain situations present themselves. And then there's discretionary legislation. So what I simply did was to look for various keywords that might be indicative of a legislation, piece of legislation that might reflect conservation, rebuilding, and might be a potentially important tool in that regard. So the U.S. Act, here are the four keywords: recovery, rebuild, overfishing, and target. And you can see the number of instances that each of these words appears in their legislation. In the Fisheries Act, the only word that appears is recovery, and it's only there for the recovery of legal costs, or costs associated with legal actions, not with recovery of a stock. The Oceans Act doesn't mention any of those four words. The Species at Risk Act mentions recovery 83 times. Not surprisingly, but this is, many people felt, and many people still do feel, that essentially the failure of the Fisheries Act to provide and protect for fisheries, in other words, it's been under the auspices of the Fisheries Act that declines took place, that perhaps that's not the most effective legislative tool for rebuilding, that perhaps the Species at Risk Act might be a more effective tool. Let's go back to this prescriptive versus discretionary legislation. And one reflection of this is by looking at how often the verbs must, shall, and may appear, particularly when associated with what a minister must do. So the minister must, minister shall, minister may. How often do those combinations appear? In the U.S. Act, there's a lot of minister shalls and a couple of minister musts. The Fisheries Act, it's highly discretionary. So whereas the U.S. Act was mainly prescriptive, where there's the word shall is predominant, the Fisheries Act is highly discretionary. In fact, again, as probably many of you know, the Minister of Fisheries and Oceans has arguably the greatest discretionary power of any minister of the Crown. The Oceans Act, different act, same minister, and again we see that there's a high degree of discretion available to the minister. The Species at Risk Act, on the other hand, is highly proscriptive, with an emphasis on what the minister must do under various situations. Now, there are arguments for and against discretion. There are arguments for and against prescriptive legislative tools. I'm basically looking at it from the perspective of it's been 16 years since the greatest numerical loss of a vertebrate in Canadian history, and there doesn't seem to be a lot of incentive or a lot of determination to take meaningful action under our current legislative framework. So what can we do about it? What's something positive to take out of all of this? Well, John Fraser, in his opening lecture of this series, asked the question, who speaks for the oceans and what are they doing about it? And the message seemed to be those who are speaking for the oceans perhaps are not doing nearly as much as they could be.
You're listening to Professor Jeff Hutchings with his Lament for a Nation's Oceans on Radio EcoShock.
And so one of the recommendations I would make the strong argument for is leadership. Now, that's an overused term, unfortunately, but there is a place for honorable, accountable, and effective leadership with respect to our oceans. That from my perspective, seems to be missing. And it starts with the Prime Minister, and it simmers down through Cabinet to the Minister of Fisheries and Oceans, and indeed the upper echelons of the bureaucracy. One means, for example, by which the Prime Minister can make his minister accountable is through what's called a mandate letter. And this is something that ministers receive from the Prime Minister. It's drafted by the Privy Council Office. And these letters basically outline the expectations of the Prime Minister and the government for the particular portfolio in question. It is through that letter that a Prime Minister can make a minister accountable, even if the legislation does not. Perhaps there's an argument that can be made for some form of restructuring of fisheries and ocean governance. And here I'm thinking primarily of legislation. And I'm thinking here of legislation that makes explicit the reference points that the UN has advised we should have. It's in agreements to which, not just the UN one, to which Canada is a signatory under international a variety of international agreements, establish target and limit reference points, implement rules for how to harvest depleted and declining stocks, introduce proscriptive legislation to end overfishing and to rebuild depleted stocks. This might sound over the top. This is exactly what the 2007 amendments to that U.S. Act stipulate. They were written into law in January of 2007 to end overfishing by 2011. And lastly, there is this regulatory conflict within the department. And it's not just DFO. Canadian Food Inspection Agency is another. We've got dual roles by the department. On the one hand, they're there to promote industry. On the other hand, they're there to conserve the resources. And this dichotomy creates conflict, and it's not always the end result, and isn't always a happy one for either side. We require some environmentally responsible behavior on the part of consumers, more so than what we have had. And with fish products, when you think about it, when you go to the supermarket, fish are probably the only thing for which the country of origin or the province of origin isn't indicated. You buy broccoli, you buy lettuce, it tells you where it comes from. You go to the fishmonger, you can't tell where the fish comes from, it's just slabs. At least you can't in Halifax. Maybe you can in Vancouver, but you can't in Halifax. You can't tell where the fish comes from. And a lot of people are feeling that some form of certification is perhaps going to be an effective way to change the behavior of consumers. It's a way potentially of informing consumers as to what is or may not be sustainable products or products to purchase from sustainable fisheries. The Marine Stewardship Council, based in the UK, self-describes itself as the world's leading certification and eco-labeling program for sustainable seafood. What this council does is it basically employs third parties to evaluate the sustainability of various fisheries. And if the council feels that it warrants its certification, then that stamp will appear on the outside of the packaging for the various products, and that is meant to be an identification to consumers that this is a product that you can purchase, perhaps with some conscience. And a key criterion for the council is that depleted fisheries, before they're going to certify a fishery, that the depleted fisheries must be allowed to recover and rebuild to a level. Again, you're hearing the same words. Consistent with the precautionary approach within a specified time frame. So this is a key criterion before things are going to be certified. This might, oddly enough, actually lead to some of these reference points in some form or another. The Department of Fisheries and Oceans is very, very concerned and keen on this because what is it appears as though might be happening is various countries, indeed the EU, might start using certification programs as a mean of determining which products get imported and exported in the global market. And so now the Department of Fisheries and Oceans is very keen on this eco-certification process. And among other things, they've identified, they say, new policies and tools like the fishery checklist, which will help deliver these requirements and monitor progress. The checklist is an internal assessment tool that covers the main subjects examined during a certification. Do we need a checklist as opposed to target and limit reference points? I'm not sure that we do. This checklist has 76 questions in it. Now, I have been unable to determine what the 76 questions are, but I am concerned about the potential utility of a 76-question checklist as a primary basis for determining sustainability in the absence of limit and target reference points. This is the only slide in the DFO's presentation that talks about the way forward. DFO will continue to find ways of helping industry to meet market challenges where we can. We will continue to seek ways to better support the certification process. And what slightly bothers me, or I find slightly worrisome, is that if this does lead to some potential meaningful change, it's not because of a perceived need to do something right from a conservation perspective. It's based on a perceived need to assist industry. Now, there's nothing wrong with assisting industry, but that should not be the primary reason for these measures. Indeed, I would have preferred something along the lines that we will establish target reference points and legislatively mandated rebuilding targets and recovery timelines for all overfished, depleted stocks. Margaret Atwood, in her Massey lecture series, at least in the book accompanying it, makes the point. She says that every environmental debt comes with a date on which payment is due. And many people feel that that due date for oceanic environmental debt is due pretty close to now. But it begs the question of what we're going to give up. We seem to be highly reluctant to pay any short-term costs financially, anything that's going to put us out, anything that's going to reduce our level of affluence. If it doesn't cost us anything, we'll change our behavior. We'll use canvas bags at the supermarket instead of plastic bags. But with notable exceptions in society, and I'm sure most everybody in this room would be part of that exception, not everyone agrees with that. Many people over the age of 35 do not seem willing to pay the short-term costs for the longer-term benefits. And when I say short-term costs, these are costs that should be borne by all Canadians. Overfishing, overexploitation is not simply a matter of pointing a finger at a minister, pointing a finger at a bureaucrat, pointing a finger at the fisherman. We're all involved, we're all implicated, and we all need to pay for it in some manner of other. So what will you give up is a highly relevant question. Well, some aren't willing to give up fishing. This is Southern Gulf Atlantic cod. The upper figure shows you the trend in spawning stock biomass, that's in the circles, from 1950 to present day. At one time, in fact at two times in that 50-year period, there were a lot of Southern Gulf cod. In a report published this year, it's predicted that Southern Gulf cod will be extirpated in 20 years with a fishery and in 40 years without a fishery. This is part of the environmental debt. Almost unimaginable that a cod stock could become extirpated. So I don't have a lot of faith in our current generation. I think generational change is required. I see it in the students that come to the university. They're interested in environmental studies. They're interested in changing behaviors and conservation-minded ways in a way that most of the rest of us, some of us do, some of us practice it to greater or lesser degrees. Some just talk about it. That's my daughter on the left, and I think it's going to be people up to her, and it's about educating youngsters and educating children and educating teenagers about the oceans, about biodiversity, that's going to lead to a sense of proprietary, a sense of stewardship and ownership. I get back to the point that the minister is there not simply to protect biodiversity for industry, it's held in trust for all Canadians. Oceans are a long way away from most of us, especially the main part of the central part of the country. And politicians will not change if there is not public pressure to change. And how does one inform or educate and involve and interest people in the oceans? It's hard to do. But Aquaria strike me as an incredibly important and well-deserved way to educate and to get people excited. One example of another type of program is something that Robert Bateman, the artist, has developed called the Get to Know program. And he makes the argument that young people today probably are aware or could identify several hundred corporate logos, but might not be able to identify more than a dozen species. There's probably truth to that. And so this type of program has things such as a parks program here in Vancouver and in the greater Toronto area that involves kids and their parents. There are art programs and essay programs. Contests for young people. And there's an interactive CD that's been distributed to more than 1,300 schools in Vancouver, Calgary, Edmonton, and Toronto, again as an educational tool, not for our generation, but for the next one. And lastly, we require an historical perspective. We sorely require an historical perspective. Let me go back to this marine stewardship program. In August of this year, it made the announcement that it had certified the first Canadian fishery. And that first Canadian fishery to receive MSC certification was the northern shrimp fishery off Newfoundland and Labrador. The council agreed or felt that it was a certifiable fishery because it was a sustainable one and it met all the right criteria. The first thing that came to my mind when I was interviewed about this certification was I thought the only reason there's so many shrimp is because there are so few cod. And it's a pattern that's repeated in many places, in Iceland, off Norway, other parts of the world where cod have declined, shrimp have gone up in abundance. We're not catching more shrimp today because there's more shrimp. Shrimp have always been much more valuable than cod ever was. So there's something slightly odd about certifying a fishery as a sustainable one and communicating that to consumers when it's essentially a product of severe overexploitation. To conclude then, I do personally lament for our nation's oceans. Since the extension of the exclusive economic zone to 200 nautical miles in 1977, a single human generation has passed during which Canada's oceans have experienced historically unprecedented biological change. The Arctic Ocean is no longer a refuge from the environmental detritus of socioeconomic ambivalence. Is home to culturally and biologically integral species, such as polar bear and beluga whale, that are increasingly threatened with extinction. The iconic Pacific salmon and Canada's largest fish, the basking shark and the white sturgeon, all of which depend on the coastal waters of British Columbia, are imperiled throughout much of their respective ranges. And the Atlantic has borne witness to the greatest numerical loss of a vertebrate in Canadian history, the Atlantic cod. Biological depredation of the waters bordered by the longest coastline in the world ultimately reflects, to my mind, ineffectual leadership and disingenuous commitment to environmental sustainability. There is a clear need to replace governmental and societal lip service with meaningful responses to overexploitation, habitat alteration, and climate change. And I've tried to suggest this evening that such responses may require committed and honorable leadership on the national and international stages, legislative restructuring of some form of our responsibilities to overfished stocks, environmentally informed consumer behavior, an historical perspective to counter the ever-pervasive shifting baseline of what constitutes normalcy, and acceptance of the inevitable short-term socioeconomic costs borne by all Canadians that will be required to achieve longer-term societal benefits. Recovering and maintaining the health of our oceans is a non-negotiable responsibility to future generations that we can neither afford nor have the right to ignore. Thank you for your attention.
That was Professor Jeff Hutchings of Dalhousie University and Chair of the Committee on the Status of Endangered Wildlife in Canada, COSWIC. This recording was made by Alex Smith of Radio EcoShock with the kind permission of Simon Fraser University at the WASC Centre in Vancouver, Canada, on October 22, 2008. Following the speech, there were two official respondents, Jamie Alley, Director, Oceans and Fisheries Division of the BC Ministry of the Environment, and Dr. Daniel Pauly, Director, Fisheries Centre, University of British Columbia. These comments, plus questions from the well-informed audience, are available as a separate free MP3 download from www.ecoshock.org. Look for Oceans in the Audio On Demand menu on our main page. That's the Radio EcoShock show for this week. Find all our past programs at ecoshock.org. Thank you for joining us.
I give you my voice. Together we make a stand. We're making the right choice for our future and for our children too. Hear the cries of the ocean. Cries of caution from our ancestors. We can't be defeated. United we can win.
Adi, Adi, Adi.
ocean. This is my future, my choice. This ocean is my home. This is our ocean. This is our future.